It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Well, I'm just, I'm joking, but it's just like, it's unbelievable the polarization in the U.S. I mean, it's like far more profound than I think people are really giving it credit for.
What I find equally scary is how normalized it's become, right? So many people just sort of said, yeah, there's going to be violence this week, right? Yeah. And there's a certain complacency with that I find equally disturbing.
Yeah. And to your point, what are the odds that anybody that's got a polarized position could ever have their mind changed by virtually any sort of evidence?
I don't know about that. I'll take your dystopia and go even more dystopian. I think that the danger is not in their rigidity, but in their extremism. That it's not that their head is too closed for them to change. It's that they are so volatile that they're likely to swing to any extreme position just out of a desire, out of the fun of it, for lack of a better word, right? Out of the excitement of zealotry, of the excitement of extremism. That's what I see on the internet. That's what worries me, is that it's an inflationary attention-getting effect. That, you know, rather than these people being stubborn, I would say that they're superficial, and their superficiality lends themselves to ludicrous extremism. This is all great podcast stuff, so I hope you're recording, Mark.
I was actually running the test. This was all the test beat, and I just let it roll because I figure this is all going to end up in the show. Even though when I was going to ask you guys what you wanted to talk about this week, I was going to say I know what I don't want to talk about this week. And I was, you know, Jesse, your update on the MetaView's mailing list and where you're going with it and introducing the mini salons, and you the summation at the end, I thought was so perfect. You know, for events going on this week, here's two goats on top of three tons of horse shit. Now that's all I really want to say about the election this week.
Although no, it was actually two ducks, because the idea is that they represented the candidates.
Yes, of course they do.
I just missed a photo of them fornicating.
Oh, God, that
would have
been.
I almost had a photo of two ducks fornicating on, like, four tons of horse shit. So
there would have been no better metaphor for the times we live in. I think the most important thing that has happened this week was on Tuesday as well, and it was the release of TV Ontario's documentary of Teenage Head. You know, picture my face, the story of Teenage Head. And I think that is the most relevant thing that's happened this week. Not to downplay Teenage Head, because I almost said it kind of tritely, but I'm watching this thinking, yeah, man, these guys, they really got a screwball pitched at them by fate. And they really could have really set the world on fire. And they still do. I mean, people still love their music. You probably have no idea who we're talking about, do you, Charles?
Yeah, I think I need a little backstory here.
So Jesse grew up in Toronto, right? I grew up in Cambridge, Ontario. Between Toronto and Cambridge, there's a town called Hamilton, Ontario, Steel Town. And out of this town came a band. I think they're like 10 years older than Jesse and I are. And they were called Teenage Head. And they came out in, what was it, the mid-80s, I guess?
70s, no?
70s, yeah, actually the 70s. And they were Canada's answer to the Ramones. And they put out two albums that did really well. They were doing great in Canada, and they were lining up to attack the States. They were finishing their third album, and they had some dates booked in the States, and they were going to play, I don't know where it was. And they got into a car accident. And so I think that they almost paralyzed the guitar player, but it derailed them for years. And so they just never got, you know, they just never got that momentum back. And then, I guess, fast forward to 2008, Frankie Venom passed away. Was it 2008 or was it much earlier? No, it was just 2008, I think. But they're, yeah. So a documentary about them came out this week, and I just find it pretty interesting and nostalgic and that sort of thing.
And because you brought it up, we will link to it in the show notes.
And we'll get demonetized again.
Well, we don't have to put it on the show. I'm just saying it'll be one of the links.
Oh, links in the show notes. Yeah, we'll do that for sure, for sure.
Well, it's almost like this close to fame.
Yeah.
Know? And then what's that dividing line?
Yeah. And it's heartbreaking, really. I mean, there's no guarantee they would have caught on in the States. Who knows? But you'd rather, yeah, we went to the States and it just didn't catch on than we were about to when life threw this curveball at us and that was the end of it. But
although changing subject slightly and kind of ushering us into today's discussion, you know, one of the paradoxes or cliches of Canadian industry, Canadian talent, is that, you know, we have this tall poppy syndrome where as soon as someone gains a certain amount of success, you know, other Canadians want to take them down. So the rule has always been that if you want to be successful, if you want the respect of your peers in industry, you have to make it big in America,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
To make it big in Canada is not enough,
yeah.
right? America is really where the Canadians judge each other when it comes to success in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And I was kind of thinking this week, I wonder if that's changed. I wonder if because of the pandemic, because of the election, because of the sort of, you know, sitting beside Rome burning and roasting your marshmallows on that fire, you start contemplating, you know, a different way of measuring success. And I don't think Canadians are ever going to be mature enough to measure it domestically. Like, I don't think we're ever going to be like, all right, you made it here, you're great. But it's why, you know, this talk about a UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand trade pact, I think becomes interesting. And the way in which either Europe or Asia or even Latin America starts becoming increasingly relevant for Canada. And we start modifying our talent. We start thinking about success, not based on the American stage, but based on the global stage, right? Because, you know, to your point about the trajectory of Canadian bands, well, yes, the expectation was to go to America. Many went to Europe, and in going to Europe, found, you know, equal success, certainly commercial and critical success. But traditionally, that never came with the same weight, and I kind of speculate that that's changing.
I'm thinking of Saga. Do you remember them? They were from Toronto, I think, like Scarborough, and they're like big in Germany, filling stadiums in Germany. And they're this kind of guitar-based prog rock thing with heavy keyboards. And but they just never really caught on anywhere else.
David Hasselhoff effect.
Yeah. We have a little pause. Do you guys mind if I just very quickly make sure that this is, because I didn't get the test, so just before we have a complete catastrophe, let's just hang on for one sec, okay? Thanks.
Yeah, colonizing Mars.
Yeah.
We're good, exactly. And I came back just in time to catch the colonizing Mars bit.
Oh, you didn't hear me talk about WeChat as the global dominant currency.
No, because I had the tab muted, so. Oh, WeChat, yeah. It's...
Anyway, you want to do the intro?
Mark Jeftovic here with another episode of the Access of Easy Salon. I have Jesse Hirsch from the Ottawa Valley, Charles Hugh Smith from the Big Island in Hawaii. I'm in Etobicoke, which is on the west side of Toronto, and this is November 5th, and we already went through a whole spiel of what we don't want to talk about today. So what do we want to talk about today? I've got something. Charles,
go right ahead.
Well, we don't have to talk about it now, but we have Doc Searles coming on next week. He's going to be our guest, author of the Clue Train Manifesto and the book I rave about a lot, Intention Economy. And another friend of, like a contemporary of Doc Searles and their good friends, is Elliot Noss from Two Cows. And I was going back and forth with Elliot on email about something else over the past couple of days. And I said, you know, Doc Searles is coming on next week. Maybe you should come on in the future as well, because we were talking about the whole network state thing, and he said to me, can you give me a high-level overview of what you mean by the network state? And because he said something quite interesting in our email exchange, which made me say, you should come on. And I won't share it here because it was email and it should be best once he's on here. But it did, you know, I thought, okay, well, how would I explain this? Because we talk about this a lot and we've never really said exactly what we mean by it. We don't have to talk about that right now. I know, Charles, you were going to put your topics forward.
No, I mean, I was liking what Jesse was talking about with the extremely complex and oh so human interplay between extremism, zealotry, closed-mindedness, and the emotions that generate those kinds of things. And I don't really want to go into some great depth. I would just add that psychologists have studied this and discovered, not to our surprise, I don't think, that when your position that you hold so dear is under attack, you actually embrace it even more feverishly, because it's now part of your identity and your mythology and on and on, right? So we seem to be living that out in real time.
This is what makes me so crazy about cancel culture and deplatforming, because it's like Streisand effect. Look it up. Like, it's just, it's the, do you want the exact opposite to happen?
But that's the point in both cases, that, you know, the point is the hunt, right? The thrill is the chase. You know, the reason, you know, the idea that extremists are not stubborn, they're extremists, sort of suggests that it doesn't really matter where their zealotry is focused, but that they have the opportunity to practice zealotry, right? We all sort of joke about the comic. I think of the XKCD version, where it's like, oh, come to bed, honey. I can't. There's someone wrong on the internet, right? You know, the idea that one has a moral responsibility to respond to these things. And so to tie some of this together, allow me to bring up a book, Marshall McLuhan's Global Village. And I do this partly because, I mean, to go to your point, Mark, about the network state, globalization is dead. Long live the global village, right? In that, while as we record this, the election that we dare not speak about is undecided, it doesn't really matter who wins. Globalization as we know it is dead. Right, the death knell was the pandemic. It was kind of dying before that, but the vision of globalization that has reigned for the last 20-30 years is falling apart, and I would argue it's being replaced by the global village. And the global village is not globalization, because globalization was a kind of neoliberal kind of trade liberalization vision of the global economy. Versus the global village is much more like a shanty town in terms of it's improvised, it's diverse, it's not entirely all connected, it's not unified in terms of political jurisdiction. It's a network state. It's a network of network states in the sense that it's much more makeshift, but primarily reflects our psychology. That the internet is what creates the global village. The internet is what allows us to learn about anywhere we want in the world, yet still remain where we are. And there's a bit of a paradox to that. But the sly answer to the question of what is the network state, you go, well, Facebook, that's one, right? You go, well, Google, that's another. And it sort of gets people to bend their definition. Like, why would we call these companies, even though legally they are, when they act as much something much greater than that? And that's the point of the network state, is to use a metaphor, to use language, to try to conceptualize these things. And one of the things that we've talked about in this podcast many times that's in this book, The Global Village, is the tetrad, which is, you know, instead of dialectical theory, it's Marshall McLuhan's laws of media, the idea that each new technology enhances, reverses, obsolesces, and retrieves some type of power. And that's what I mean by the volatile extremist. right? The extremist is not digging themselves in a bunker. They're fighting it out on the internet. So their desire is just to fight. That's why QAnon is such a brilliant LARP, right? A live action role-playing game, because it allows people to play. It allows them to have a role. And that's my fear when it comes to extremism today, that it's just a game. And like a video game, people are going to keep going no matter what, because the joy is in playing, not necessarily winning or losing.
I have, this is a bit of an aside, but I've been working on this just very casually over the past few months, a theory on who invented QAnon. And I think it goes back to this fiction book. Never mind, let's move on. Kubrick's Game, right here. Sorry, I don't have it as fancy as you have yours. So this was a book that was written by a guy named Derek Taylor Kent about these people finding conspiracies in Stanley Kubrick novels. And there's a shady, like, hidden force in it called Q. And this book came out in 2016, several months before the whole QAnon phenom erupted. And I just thought, you know, whoever thought that up.
It could be correlation.
Yeah.
But I agree. That's an obvious.
But to bring things back sort of on track. All right, I have to go again to another book that we've talked about in here before, which is Jaron Lanier's 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. And that what gets overlooked or not enough attention is the fact that I think some of these big tech platforms like Facebook actually optimize for that polarization. So I notice, I mean, I've really been trying to rein myself in on social media, and I understand I probably come across like a raving lunatic to a lot of people, some of which may be on this call. My wife won't even friend me on Facebook. She's like, no thanks, good luck with all that. When you come back into the real world, we're here. And so what I notice is if I'm going too back and forth with someone and getting a little sick of it, I'll unfollow that person. I'll remain friends, but I'll unfollow them, and then sometimes I'll try and get a conversation going on private message or email, just to sort of like, let's just reground our relationship and our friendship back to something that's not about politics or something. And then what happens is I go back to my Facebook timeline, and suddenly there's somebody else from a different angle of the political spectrum, and I'm seeing all their posts are getting shoved in my face all the time. And I never saw them until I sort of muted the other one. And then I might mute that person, and suddenly there's another one. And I suspect that Facebook has an algo that says, okay, we're going to group all the people into different political camps, and we're going to make sure that they're seeing each other's material, so that, I know this might be drifting a little conspiratorially, but they're optimizing for dopamine hits, we know that. They're optimizing for polarity, for polarization. I think it's just a no-brainer.
So where I push back a little is they're not doing political, they're doing psychogeographic. And right. The psychogeographic happened to be political. Right?
Yes. So, yeah, and this,
and this is where Facebook, you know, they're optimizing for dopamine while also being stupid about the political consequences.
Right.
So they're not thinking about what'll happen. Like, they're not thinking, oh, Mark is going to play whack-a-mole with, you know, this little specific part of the political spectrum. But that is the consequence of them creating the system they have. And it's not just that. Like they don't seek to create polarization. It's just a consequence of their obliviousness. Or dare I arrogantly say, it's a consequence of their philosophical illiteracy. Mm-hmm. Right? Because they don't understand philosophy, because they don't think about politics. They don't anticipate the way in which that pursuit of dopamine has unintended consequences.
I found about maybe 18 months ago, maybe a little less, I had to take a step back and make a concerted effort to sort of search out material that would sort of pull me back towards the center. Actually, doing this podcast is part of that for me, because we are a diverse group. Philosophically, politically speaking. And so we have that what we talk about, the Venn diagram, the overlap where we have this confluence in the center and we don't agree on everything. I always like the old Abraham Lincoln quote, if two or three people agree on everything, then one of them's unnecessary, or two of them are unnecessary. So I like that, but I found that a kind of exhaustion set in for me, where just it was like just everything was just all polarization all the time. So I'm starting to curate my social media timelines very differently. So it's like I might agree with these people on some of these things, but I need them to shut up, right? And I need to just focus on other things. Hidden Forces, the podcast that you and I both subscribe to, that was a stabilizing force in my mind, because he just sort of exudes this reasonableness about him, no matter who he's talking to and where they're coming from, even if he doesn't agree with them. And I don't know, I think it would be nice if there were platforms that kind of incentivized that, you know, regrounding, retrenchment. How can we start getting people to just take half steps back towards the center? Might help de-escalate things a lot.
You know, let me add my heavily depreciated two cents. I think this is all really, really topical, you know, and I would just want to add two points. One is what we're talking about, the attention economy. We're talking about, I think, the human psychology has shifted as part of the network state. It would be my part of my definition of the network state is people's sense of identity and very possibly their sense of economic security has shifted from the nation state to internet-based networks. And so just to give an example, we're talking about, you know, having an extreme position or any position, even trying to be reasonable. You know, 20 years ago, if you were on the internet and you could put out a blog post or an essay or something like that. And more than likely, if you were an average person, you got like three people looking at it, you know, your spouse or, you know, mate, you conned your mom into looking at it. And then some random person hit upon it or whatever. Like, you didn't have an audience, right? And so therefore, your attention feedback was so minimal that you really had to be doing it for something other than, you know, likes or attention, right? Well, now that has ramped up to where, as we've often talked here about TikTok and other social media platforms, it doesn't take that much for you to hit the jackpot. And suddenly you have an identity that you would never have been possible in a nation state, where your identity as a citizen and so on was sort of sublimated or implicit, but how are you gonna get attention? Well, you can join the 4th of July parade or, you know, Bastille Day or something like that. But you know what I mean? It's like your identity was not coming from the amount of attention you're getting. And I also want to mention the economic thing here, because there's a lot of people who are starting to earn money off of what we would call the network state, which is things like Etsy and a lot of things that are networks, and many of them are corporate run, but not all of them are. And the idea is that your loyalty, your economic loyalty, is starting to fray to the nation state, you know? And for instance, you can pay for a service in Bitcoin. And so therefore I wanted to bring up that the network state is a physical thing, in the sense that there are these servers and these connections and, you know, this whole network that connects anybody that, you know, can get a connection. And it's psychological, like it's a psychological state of how we identify who we are and where our place in the world is and how we draw psychological sustenance, you know. And but it's also an economic thing, that it's not to say that the nation states don't, you know, have this enormous financial and economic power, but the network state, to me, has an economic, financial sort of function.
And that's where I think WeChat is such an interesting case example, because WeChat is the type of integrated network state that Facebook aspires to, partly because they have the currency, you know, but also because they have much more of an open marketplace than Facebook allows, or that Facebook permits, and that Facebook's primary goal is Facebook. But WeChat also sort of represents a kind of digital imperialism, right? A way in which China can extend influence around the world the way that America already has with its digital platforms. And I was earlier kind of hypothesizing about, you know, we in a previous episode talked about the Chinese central bank digital currency. And, you know, that a digital currency is in and of itself a surveillance mechanism. And that if you imagine that China were to mandate with its Belt and Road Initiative that any infrastructure spending, say they, you know, set up a harbor in Pakistan or an airport in an African republic, that they demand that the payments are made in their digital currency. So it's a way for them to use their export development initiative to be pushing their currency out there. Now, once I articulated that, it seemed like nonsense. I was like, no, it doesn't make sense. I mean, you know, the Chinese government, I don't think is that competent. I don't think they could actually get this digital currency to a point of work like that. But WeChat's already got it, right? All that China has to do is they could have their own central bank digital currency so that they could convert the money they make off WeChat back into state funds. But, you know, at what point does the network state currency infrastructure become far more resilient and effective than the state-based infrastructure? And that's part of what enables the transition from the nation state to the network state. Because the other end of that scenario is the U.S., right? Either A, the Chinese central bank digital currency rises so quickly that the U.S. is caught flat-footed, and they realize that it's a surveillance system, and they see China spread it around the world, threatening it as an alternative to the U.S. dollar as the kind of, you know, currency, the global currency, the lingua franca. Sorry, not you get what I'm saying. And then they realize, well, they need a digital currency. They can't develop their own fast enough because they're the U.S. government. They can't do anything fast. And lo and behold, Facebook's already got one ready. So they're like, well, it's either China or Facebook. So I guess we got to go with Facebook because at least it's not China, right? And it's that type of sort of by default that, you know, for lack of a better alternative public policy, that I think is what is going to enable the transition from the nation state to the network state. But Mark, about centrism, I'm not sure that that's the solution. I think the joy of zealotry, I think the joy of the battle, the mimetic war, right? As Doucheface Jones called it information war, but I prefer the meme wars. And I think what we're missing is humor. You know, we have humor as a weapon. We have humor in the vindictive sense, but we don't have humor in the disarming sense. And that's how I would configure these platforms differently, is not to try to artificially create consensus where there isn't, but to make it easy for everyone to mock each other and take the piss out of each other as a way of just kind of making everyone realize this is all just make-believe. This is just a LARP. Like, we're just having fun here. To your point, Mark, we got to go back and get analog and reconnect with each other. And maybe social media just can't do that. But what it can do is help us laugh and help us maybe not take all this nonsense so seriously.
Well, the problem with humor is everybody is offended by everything now. So humor is almost a non-starter. But
I disagree. I think that's a cop-out. And I think that it could be done in a way that was both respectful and still taking the piss.
Oh my God, it was a joke, son. You're too low to the ground. They're going straight over your head. But
It's true.
But to your point about digital currencies, I mean, you're not wrong about any of that. And I think what we will see is that kind of fusion between, it's almost, you know, a newfangled public-private partnership. One of the articles I was reading this week, it was a transcript of an interview with Elliot, so I won't talk too much about it. But he just mentioned very offhandedly how the new auction regimen for a slice of the wireless spectrum was authored by Google, like on behalf of the U.S. government. And it's sort of like you see that sort of, okay, that sort of coming together of that. And the one thing I would sort of fill in some blanks is the U.S. is not, I won't say they're not far behind on the digital cash scene, but they are motivated and they have the will there to bring it about. They've already been talking about Fed coins, like digital Fed wallets. I imagine they will try to do it themselves, but I can easily see something like a Libra or you know, Google or Amazon or some sort of fusion of them all. And what this comes down to is the impending de-dollarization moment of the world. Like, everybody knows it's coming. The U.S. dollar as world reserve currency in its current form will not prevail, will not continue. And it's Mr. Robot, season 5, you know. It's, you know, one season past the one that they finished off on, where you find out that this is all about the epic global structure to have, you know, struggle to have the global digital currency. And again, how that digital currency takes form will have so much impact on everybody's day-to-day lives that I lose sleep over that, really, because I think of all the worst possible things that will be in a digital currency, and I just assume that those will be in there.
Well, let me jump in here on that wonderful topic, because and Mark, to go back to one of your key phrases here, what's being optimized? You know, that's always a good question, along with to whose benefit, right?
Yeah.
And so Jesse's example of WeChat or Facebook's Libra, these are basically corporate issued digital currencies, right? Now they might have an advantage over nation state in that maybe they won't hyperinflate because that would, you know, the corporate interest is like, well, why should we depreciate our currency and destroy it? Well, the nation state is a mix of all these competing elites. And so destroying the currency becomes the default pathway because everybody's just trying to get their place at the feeding trough, right? So you end up defaulting to self-destruction in a way that corporations can do. I mean, look at Nokia. But what about an open source, you know, owned by its users currency, kind of like my, you know, climb system idea of the labor-backed currency? And so what excites me is the possibility there could be non-corporate, non-state currencies, you know, and that it's another one of those adoption things. If it's optimized for something other than the control of an elite or, you know, a corporate clique, and it actually incentivizes people to use it, well, and to whose benefit? The user. Hey, all those things could align and this thing could really take off, you know, and hopefully there'd be competing non-corporate digital currencies that were democratized, not like Bitcoin that you have to mine it. It's issued to users for using the network, essentially.
I mean, you raise an interesting linchpin, which, you know, on the one hand, we're talking about the sort of technical side of currencies. We're talking about the political side of currencies and the economic impacts of these currencies. But it strikes me there's a key policy that I think I took for granted up until this conversation, but I'm now really trying to think about, and that's the notion of exchange. Because on the one hand, when I was listening to you, Charles, I was thinking, well, you know, regardless of whatever digital currency is first past the post or becomes most dominant, the normalization of digital currencies will potentially mean an infinite amount of digital currencies. I mean, that's partly what we're seeing with the quote unquote shit coins or the way in which open source cryptocurrencies mean that anyone can start one. And I actually like that. I don't have a problem with that. And, you know, I'm willing to sort of trade off having a dominant digital currency if it means a near infinite amount of exchangeable currencies so that you could have competing models. You could have, you know, local currencies, labor centric currencies, you know, fully democratized and distributed currencies in the sense of distributed wealth, not just distributed control of the financial infrastructure. You know, all of that I think has great potential, but it strikes me that the devil's in the details. That, you know, there's ways in which, especially if the nation state understands its vulnerability to the network state, that in the, whether the United States or China, in putting forward a digital currency, simultaneously outlaws the exchange of other digital currencies. Not on a technical level, but on a legal level, which could either be the last gasp of the nation state or the start of the war between the two. Because technically we know that they wouldn't be able to prevent that. But legally, because our bodies are still in nations, there's still a lot they can do to try to forbid it. So I, again, it was not something I thought of previously because I kind of took for granted that exchanging these currencies is inevitable and something that would happen. But we should never underestimate the delusional nature of power, especially in the hands of the nation state.
I agree that the more alternative cryptocurrencies there are, the better, and that communities should be free to create them for their own purposes, even within closed ecosystems. But I also believe that there is a role for Bitcoin, or if not Bitcoin, an eventual successor to Bitcoin that we don't even recognize as Bitcoin, but either or, there has to be this elephant in the room, that this 800-pound gorilla of non-national cryptocurrencies that maybe some will peg to, maybe they won't, but the point is that there's something out there that has achieved critical mass and has demonstrated proof of concept and that economic actors put real value in. And that shows the flows of big capital. I wrote really briefly in another article about a week ago. It's actually, if you take aside institutional corruption and that kind of thing, and you just think about large pools of capital overseen by fiduciaries like pension funds and endowments and stuff like that, they're the one pool of capital you can count on over the long run to be one of the least crazy actors in an equation, because they have to govern over this enormous sum of money that you can't just move out of one asset into another at the snap of a finger. And so you can count on them to sort of almost be the voice of reason in an economic shitstorm, and although they're absent without leave lately. But my point is that as you see those large economic actors stake some value on one of these cryptocurrencies, it sort of validates the entire space. And if it's a non-national space, it opens up that entire sphere for validating the next, you know, beyond the nation state. That's why I've always had this appreciation for Bitcoin as, you know, having run the 4-minute mile and demonstrated it to be possible and still the front runner and the dominant player in the space.
I hear you, but I feel we're setting the bar too low. I agree generally with your sentiment. I'd love to see leadership, you know, and I'm open to that leadership coming from a corporation. And I say this as someone who, you know, has anti-capitalist leanings or kind of oppositional leanings. I would love to see a politician sort of buck the trend of the, you know, the BS and the, you know, like following the polls rather than saying what they believe. And that's where I think, to go back to our conversation about zealotry and extremism versus centrism, I think what we need is leadership. And ironically, I think the template for this leadership over the last 10 or 20 years has been comedians, right? It's been the late night comedy shows. And so I think there's a real opportunity for, you know, a new class of politicians. I've joked in the past that it's YouTubers and influencers, and maybe they're not ready yet because their narcissism prevents them from, you know, speaking to the public good and mobilizing people to the greater good. So maybe in the interim, it's out of the comedy sector, who have been disrupted because of the pandemic. So, you know, they're motivated to maybe find a new vocation or a new training. But I think it's that kind of, you know, and here I'll concede to your concerns, Mark, that a comedian could be the one to defeat cancel culture, right? Like if Dave Chappelle, you know, was a presidential candidate rather than fucking Kanye West, you know, he would not only be a credible candidate, but he would end, there would be no cancel culture. Right, he would transcend it, and I think that there are a lot of other figures who, whether they're on the left, whether they're on the right, you know, they understand how to perform, they understand how to communicate, they understand how to make fun of themselves and be self-effacing, which is part of what we see. It's a credibility issue, part of how we trust people. You know, that's who I would. That's my utopia. That's who I would aspire to see. And who I think would go a long way towards healing the rifts that you know, we all recognize in society, and more to what we're trying to do in this podcast, foster a conversation of what's next. Not just what we think is going to be next, but what we want to be next and how that could work. Because, you know, let me try to bring this full circle a little. I think the other problem, and hold on, I got a graphic for this, so I'm going to switch it over. I think the other problem that we've been dealing with lately is one of public education. And I think that's absolutely true about technology, like blockchain, like AI, like open source, like some of the participatory distributed decision-making systems that are out there. It's kind of just awareness and education that if people understood that these things were an option, that if people had the knowledge of how this could work, it could be an entirely different ballgame. And the same is true with the pandemic, you know, we're about to head back into more lockdowns. I think here in Canada, our governments are a little smarter, so I don't think we're going to go full lockdown. But I am hearing reports in the United States of some jurisdictions doing full lockdown again and really going overboard because they don't know what else to do, right? Because lockdown is a policy when you have no other policies, right? It's like the worst of all defaults. And so it suggests to me that even after all these months in the pandemic, people are still not paying attention to the medical research. They're not figuring out how to use that knowledge to help themselves. And the most obvious is surface transmission. Like there's pretty much zero documented cases of people getting the virus from a surface, right? It's an airborne virus with airborne transmission. And yet people are still spending all this time cleaning up surfaces. Right. And like going through this pandemic theater of, look, we're cleaning the surface, we're keeping everyone safe. When the reality is we should be investing in HVAC systems. We should be opening our windows. We should be meeting outside. We should be thinking about air quality because it's an airport. Like, and again, it's that basic stuff that frustrates me. That makes me think as a society, what these digital platforms are failing at is public education. What we need to be doing better is public education. And that might not necessarily minimize the extremists, but neutralize the extremists, because we'll all be able to think for ourselves, and the nonsense they're spouting will appear as just that, nonsense.
Well, let me make a comment here in favor of that graphic you just deleted, which I interpreted as a graphic of the ruling planet Trantor from Foundation. No, well, Jesse, you hit on a bunch of very powerful concepts from using comedy as a healing factor, as a social factor, and also this thing about education. Unfortunately, one of the things that's happened is, as we all know, that institutions have lost legitimacy and trust, and so everybody's so busy pushing their meme that it's hard to sort out what's quote real or unreal. But before we get mine that field, I want to go back to this digital currency thing real quickly with this idea that I'm working on, but I wanted to broach here for you guys to respond to, which is imagine a nation state. Now, this is a real science fiction scenario. Imagine a nation state with the leadership that the enlightened leadership that Jesse is referring to, and realizes, hey, you know what? if we're going to be a resilient nation state, we're going to have to cede control, monopoly of the money, to as many players as want to emerge. And all we are going to impose is we're going to impose the exchangeability that Jesse mentioned, so that if you, you know, earn a currency because of work or, you know, a community, you know, thing, or you're on WeChat or, you know, whatever your currency, as long as you can translate it into the currency that you can pay taxes in, hey, everything's good. Now imagine how resilient that nation state would be compared to one that was going to cling on to its monopoly on violence, force, and currency, right? Because those things are doomed, essentially, right? For all the dynamics we've talked about. So that's where I'm actually working on a book, you know, and I don't know when I'll get it done, Mark. So it's going to be a few months, but about this concept that the nation state that's going to survive and thrive is the one that embraces degrowth and a proliferation of self-sustaining currencies. That's what I think. And there's no nation state that's got that far yet, but you know, it's at least I want to put it out there as a possibility.
And I would very briefly see your bet and raise you a distributed military force. So you get rid of the military and all the resources it takes, and you have distributed self-defense, so that the citizenry using networks is a coordinated defense force that is far more effective than a military, both when it comes to national security, but more importantly, when it comes to emergency response. Because emergency response is really where militaries in an era of climate volatility should be focused and trained. And that's where a distributed martial force, I think, is, to your point, an even more resilient state-based force.
Which in Canada is so far beyond the realm of legal possibility at the moment, but I mean, well, it'll change.
But let me just say briefly.
Why did I just lose the sound concept on both of you? Oh shit! Stop, both of you. Hang on. What the fuck?
I hope you're recording that.
Just hang on.
Your reaction is awesome. Like right in the middle of the podcast. Shit, hold on.
Okay, you guys are probably back with me now.
Yes.
I can hear you.
Yeah, so what happened is...
I was just saying, I hope you recorded your reaction, because that was gold.
Yeah, I think I got it. See, I use two different pieces of software to do the shows. I record everything on Camtasia, but so we don't have a repeat of what happened in the fabled lost first episode. Yeah. I have to run my sound through an internal sound bus, and then I have to use another piece of software called Ableton Live to trap that sound stream, and then I monitor it through my headphones, and that died. So when that died, both of your sound signals went away. Although it might have all gone onto the tape anyway, we'll find out. We are still recording.
Except it's not a tape, it's a hard drive.
Yeah.
And I only have two words for you.
Yeah.
OBS Studio.
I know.
Alas, I digress.
Yes. And I've been seeing what you've been doing all show, and I'm like, oh, okay, that looks pretty cool.
So what were we talking about?
Well, the distributed military, and we all wanted to jump in. So go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was just marveling at how libertarian and anarcho-capitalist Jesse was sounding, and how far removed from possibility it is legally in Canada to function like that. And then I said, over time, we will get there. But
what if it's not libertarian or anarcho-capitalist? What if it's internet? And what if the Venn diagram between those is a bit of an overlap? But I'm not coming from this from the libertarian and anarcho-capitalist. I'm coming from it from a much more social-centric position of communities being in control of their security. But
absolutely,
I'm also thinking that it's not just from a security perspective. It's a big snowstorm, right?
Mm-hmm.
A big flood, right? All sorts of emergencies where if you had that capacity, because the problem with Canada and its geographic expanse is the military can't really do much because they can't be everywhere at once. But there's so many rednecks in Canada that if you trained and empowered those rednecks and at the same time monitored so that they didn't abuse their power, that in and of itself could be a really resilient force. Yes. Charles?
Well, let's all great stuff, great idea. And we can look at Switzerland for a working model of this, because, of course, it's well known that they do have a self-defense force every whether it's every adult or every adult male, I'm not sure of now. But, you know, they have a military grade weapon at home and so on. And in terms of emergency services and that kind of response, I think the cantons are very self-sufficient compared to other sort of local governments. So that there is a model, for that kind of decentralized martial force, which you describe. And I think it's a brilliant concept. And of course, we're talking about a model here that can be applied. We're talking about currencies, and it can be applied to emergency responses and a bunch of other stuff, right? And so if a nation state embraced that instead of fought it, I think that nation state is going to survive. And I would say the odds of Switzerland surviving are extremely high for exactly the reason we're talking about. Very decentralized, embracing gold and Bitcoin, and neutrality, and they do have a military. In fact, I saw a display of when I last time I was at Lake Geneva, they had some Swiss fighter jets doing a little aerial show. So you have to be able to defend the borders of your nation state, right? But we're talking about a bunch, as Jesse said, not just a military response in a state of war, but most of the time the military is often doing emergency services. So good idea, and it's a model that has a lot of room to grow.
Switzerland is a great example. Parag Khanna, whose name I may be mispronouncing, but he's one of the, I guess, premier advocates of technocracy as a successor to democracy, as a form of government, has argued, and his whole premise is...
You mean predecessor?
Well, he thinks that we will grow into it, into a technocracy, in a benign way.
We haven't had democracy yet.
Okay. Leaving that aside for a moment, what I'm trying to say is, his ideal utopian model is Switzerland grafted onto Singapore. He says that is the ace, and that is the governance form of the 21st century if we can get it just right. I have my skepticism about that, but I do understand the logic behind it.
Yeah, that leaves me speechless.
Well, like I said, I wasn't an endorser of it.
Although, since we are a book-centric show, I will leave the, wrap up by saying, and I think I've mentioned this previously, there's a fantastic author, a woman named Malka Older, who wrote a book, a trilogy actually, called Infomocracy.
And I have Infomocracy when you told me about it. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a fantastic idea of a network state that is geographic and virtual. So the entire world, although not Switzerland, in her story, Switzerland is one of the holdout nation states. But the rest of the world is divided in sentinels. And sentinels are basically electoral districts that have a set amount of people. And then parties compete globally, and they don't win in consecutive territories. And the idea is that if where you live has changed governments and you don't like it, you move. Because for the most part, borders are open. So people can not only vote who they want, but if they lose, choose to go move to a different sentinel and live there. And so ironically, not to spoil it, but one of the dynamics of the trilogy is the equivalent of Google becomes more than the UN. They're not the global government, but they're like the global bureaucracy, right? Yeah. So part of the story is how people hate that Google. It's not really Google.
Yeah, it's called in the book.
But yeah. But it's that idea. And so, I mean, she's a fantastic writer. And the trilogy gives I think, a really playful and accessible way of imagining not just network states, plural, but the elections and political parties and political games that sort of come with it. But I think what I've enjoyed about our discussion today, and as we've pulled these threads in past episodes, is we're trying to imagine it not in some distant future, but in the present. Like, we're trying to imagine, how is it happening right now, based on our premise that the future's already here, it's just not evenly distributed yet, or the rearview mirror effect, that time moves so quickly that what we perceive as the present is really the past, and what we look at is the futures. What's happening right now? And that's what I think is relevant in terms of the way in which the nation state is both becoming the network state, but also that competing network states are emerging. And as residents, because I don't think citizens the right word, as residents, we can live in multiple. We can have multiple identities and, you know, multiple memberships to any of these. And so just like we hedge our bets with cryptocurrencies and maybe have some Dogecoin sitting on some, you know, air-gapped server, well, we may still at the same time have membership on some of these networks, like being an Amazon Prime member. Even though you hate the fact that the company store is rising, you're still like, well, got to make sure I'm in good status with them at the very least.
Well, it's Snow Crash.
Well, here's my wrap up. I think that's all that's really exciting to me, your summary of what we do here on this salon, you know, and I think that's a good summary of what we're trying to do. I would go back to one of Mark's comments about capital, mobile private capital being a potential force, right? That's already in existence, as to use Jesse's, we're not talking about the future. The managers there could be a third force, that we're not waiting for a sclerotic nation state to catch on to degrowth and the network state and digital currencies. They could vote because of the optimization of a non-corporate currency, and they could make that work just based on its incentives and its optimization that works for them. Like, say, a currency that gives a dividend, which I believe the currency Decred is set up to do. So, you know, somebody puts in $10 billion into a new currency, that's going to be a vote of confidence by capital that could bleed over into the other arenas that we're talking about.
Yeah, another real world example of large pools of capital or assets acting under their own optimizations was during the nadir of the precious metals bear market after 2011. I think it was after 2011. And there were always people bemoaning price manipulation, and there has been some court cases recently that's shown that that wasn't just conspiracy nuts, it was actually happening on some trading desks. But what some of the gold, or what some of the silver miners did at the nadir of that, is they said, you know what? We're not going to sell our silver into the market. We're going to put it in a warehouse. How do you like that? And so it was just large entrenched interests just rationally guarding their own interests. So it's like, if you're going to manipulate this down, then we're just going to warehouse it and sit it out. We can run these mines on low ebb, and we can just... And that's, it's that kind of rationality, rational self-interest in big capital that I think may have a productive role to play in this going forward. There's an awkward pause. Yeah, let's leave it there.
I mean, I'll end by saying it looks like it's dinner time in the chicken coop. So, always make sure that you come home to roost, as it were.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good summary, Mark. I think that is a great ending.
Okay.
It's a nice day for the party, isn't it?